Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use.
Hello and welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor is an author, scholar, columnist, and a commentator on culture and politics. And this show today is going to be on politics and some of the latest questions. We have on deck Kevin McCarthy's speakership and what else? And the Ukrainian war. So we will get to that. But first, let's take a few moments for some messages and we'll be right back.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back. I would like to remind everybody that Victor is the Martin and Neely Anderson Senior Fellow in Military History and Classics at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. He is available on his website at victorhanson.com. The name of the website is The Blade of Perseus, and you can join us as a subscriber for $5 a month or $50 a year, or you can just come on for a free subscription and get on our mailing list so that you have in your email a periodic email about what's the latest articles on Victor's website. And many of them are free. Most of them are free, in fact. But he has some great VDH Ultra articles that our subscribers, of course, are there for. And they cannot be found anywhere else. So we invite everybody to come. Hello, Victor. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. And I've just finished two pieces for the Ultra website. One is on the aggravation of Queensland healers that I've spent most of my life having, and why I like them and why they drive me absolutely blank crazy. and then age and being on a farm. And I was fixing a door the other day, and I counted how many doors on this farm open to the outside from a building, and I came up with 19. And just trying to fix one door, and I thought to myself, oh, I've got 18 more because they all are ancient. All these things. It was a big long whine. But other than that, I had a good day today, and I had a good week. It's been really raining very hard here, and the climate, I don't know if we'd call them climate denialists. They call other people that, but they're the climate denialists because they were the ones assuring us that we were never going to have a wet year again. This is not a wet year. This is a hyper wet year, and I'm pointing my finger at Jerry Brown, Emeritus Governor, and Gavin Newsom and the California legislature, because we passed over 5 years ago a $7+ billion bond. And had we just done that, what the bill, the voters wanted, and that was the Sites Reservoir in the Sacramento area and the Los Banos Grandes south of San Luis Reservoir in Temperance Flat above Millerton Lake, bigger than Millerton Lake. I think it's 600,000 acre feet. And then the other two together are almost four. So we would have had 5 million acre feet. So all this water that is going out the San Joaquin River and the Sacramento River, it would be very much needed. We could store it. But you know what they're doing? They're saying the reservoirs cannot be topped off because the snow melt's coming in March. So they're letting the water go out rather than put it in the reservoirs.
Absolutely insane.
It is insane. And it's these, there's no such thing as, I think everybody agrees with her. There is no science, as they say. Follow the science. I am the science, Dr. Fauci said. These people are anti-science. They don't believe in the science. They are cult figures. They are guided by this green, secular, atheist, agnostic religion, humanism. And they don't care anything about science or logic or data. And so you can talk to them about climate change and they don't care. John Christie, a brilliant scientist, has been doing it for years. They don't care about any suggestions that the vaccines did not quite pan out as advertised. Not saying there wasn't some efficacy, but you can get infected, as I have been three times after being vaxxed twice, and you can infect people. And so I could go on and on, but this science that I had just read, actually, that this was going to be another last year, 2022. But we were told that the scientists told us this was going to be a flash in the pan, wet December, and then it was going to peter out and we were going to be in a drought, just like last year. It doesn't really matter now because I think we're up to 150%. In many areas of annual precipitation where this last storm when it finishes. So there's enough, unless we have 80 degree weather, there's enough water and precipitation to get us through. But you'll never hear that because it has to be a perennial melodrama, psychodrama for these people. And that's the only way they get things done. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. So that's the pulse on your, you and on California as well. But let's turn to the pulse on the Congress and look at Kevin McCarthy and the speakership. What is going on there? I mean, I hope I speak maybe as one of your listeners might say as well. It seems to me, let's just get beyond this. And I want to talk about what they're going to do once they get beyond is what I'm hoping for. But what are your thoughts on this stasis on the speakership?
Well, I just literally got off Tucker Carlson as we were recording this. I think we were kind of in agreement. And I think there's something salutary of letting these people vent and saying, you know what, we want to be able to remove a speaker more quickly than or more easily than the past. We want guarantees that we're going to have a, you know, budget balanced house, at least on our side. We want to make sure you're going to investigate Hunter and the border and Afghanistan, Ukraine. That's all fine. And that's, maybe it's historic, and they've been doing that. But now it's 48 hours. What have we got, 11 votes? And here's the problem, Sammy. Number one, who do they want? Because they've established the precedent that 20 people can block anybody. So they can get to their ranks and say, we can block a group that's 10 times larger than ours. So we'll put somebody forth. And they don't understand the rules apply to them. They can't nominate anybody. None. So basically it's, you know, it's rebel without a cause. They want to go speed toward the cliff and the other guys are speeding, and then they'll see who folds first. But meanwhile, there's this Cheshire cat grin by the Democrats. They voted for Hakeem Jeffries. He got more for speaker than did Kevin McCarthy. They're just lucky you have to have a majority or he would be speaker. And they don't have any rebellion. I mean, there was not one person. When they get those talking points, I'm not saying to be like them. I'm glad that there's more discussion and raucous on the Republican side. But you're dealing with hardcore Jacobins. It's sort of like the constitutional monarchists thought they got rid of the Bourbons, and then they didn't have any idea that who they were squabbling, Danton, etc. And they had no idea who they were up against with the Robespierre brothers. And the same thing after the overthrow of the Tsar. Kerensky was this and that. They were arguing, and they looked at this Lenin guy, and he broke no dissent. And that's what the Democrats are right now. They're hardcore leftists. Somebody says, hey, I don't think we should give money to Ukraine. What was there, 18, 19 people signed a letter? Nancy Pelosi metaphorically lined them up in the guillotine and beheaded them all. That's it. Nope. No, no, you're not. And here, and you can see it on when you make the misfortune of just channel surfing those MSNBC or CNN or even network news. It's bombshell. It's a bombshell. Bombshell developments. Or the walls are closing in on Donald Trump. Walls are closing in on Donald Trump. Walls are... It's perfect party discipline. I'm not saying this to emulate them. I'm trying to suggest to the Republican, do you have any idea what you're up against? And so when you're fighting and squabbling, you look at those people, they're smiling. You look at the press, they're in a full-scale propaganda war. That's number one. Number two, they don't have any candidate, as I said. So you can talk all you want, but the moment they nominate anybody from the Freedom Caucus, there's going to be, I don't know, 20, 40, 60 people who were elected in districts that voted for, you know, Joe Biden in the popular vote. And they're going to say, no, we don't want that nut. We don't want that person to be speaker. So they're going to do to them what they're doing to Kevin McCarthy. That's two. So it's kind of a nihilism, if you think about it. And I think it's healthy for 48 hours. I said that on Tucker, that, you know, to get everybody, get it out of your system, to make McCarthy know that he's not liked completely and that he's got to be inclusive, blah, blah, blah. And then the other thing is they keep talking about talking to a Democrat, i.e. maybe we can get a vote. If either side cuts any deal with any Democrat, then they're done as a party. They got over 2-3% greater popular vote in 2022 from the American people. And they were voted to go in there and stop the madness. We can't stop the madness. We lost the presidency. We can't stop the madness in the Senate. We lost the Senate. The only branch of government is this slim margin in the House, and everybody's hopes and dreams are on that majority. The shipwreck of our dreams was the Senate and Mitch McConnell wasting money, you know, in a civil war in Alaska, not funding Blake Masters, not really giving anything to Dr. Oz until it was too late. Whatever that, you know, we've lost those. And now we've lost the two weapons in the House arsenal when you have one third of the government and a slim margin. You can shut down the government or tell people that this budget is out of control. Well, they weren't there. They pushed that through before these House members were sworn in, the outgoing House and the Senate. So they can't stop the budget. That was their own. So they have one last chance, and that's investigations. They can subpoena, they can call people. They can find out, they can put Hunter Biden under oath. They can put Dr. Fauci under oath. They can put Mark Milley and the Afghanistan under oath. I'm not saying they can elude anything, but they can get a lot of information. They can put James Comey back under oath. They can put Christopher Wray back under oath. they can find out what happened to the FBI. But they're not doing that right now. They haven't even sworn in the people who were elected. It's already into the second week almost. We're coming up on the second week of January, and there's no functionality. And so everybody's looking at this and said, you know what? We voted for you people, and we voted for you to stop the border and to stop the crime and to stop the spending and to stop this madness of cutting back on fossil fuels. And we know you can't do it because you have to have a bill through Congress that he will veto, and then you have to override, and that can't happen. But we want you at least to vote for the legislation so that the Democrats in the Senate oppose it on the record and Joe Biden opposes it on the record. And then we want you to investigate. And yet they're not doing that. Yeah. So they've broken their bond with the American people. And when I hear these people, they get up there and, you know, they, Matt Gaetz, he's going to nominate Donald Trump. He's going to give a big speech and waste the time on every minute he was talking. I was watching him on TV. I thought, well, why aren't you working on a subpoena? Donald Trump's not going to be the Speaker of the House. What's the point? What is the blank, blank point? And I know Kevin McCarthy. I know that people have legitimate criticisms. He's been there 14 years, but he won the House. So look at the whole 360 degrees. The Republicans lost the Senate. They should have won the Senate. You can argue about Herschel Walker or Oz or Blake Matt, whatever, but had they used their money wisely and then had they united and had Mitch McConnell not said, well, you know, you need good candidates and that's what, and given money for that Lisa Murkowski's Civil War and all that stuff. He had just concentrated on just two races. They could have won Pennsylvania and maybe they could have won Arizona. And he didn't do that. And I don't want to get into the Trump election, but party did not understand that we have been witnessing a revolution where 70% of the people do not vote on election day. And they were completely caught again in 2020. But you know what? Kevin McCarthy, make fun of him. In 2020, when it was a losing year for the Republicans, guess what? They lost the Senate. They lost the president. He picked up 14 seats in the House. He didn't take it back, but he picked up. And then this year, when you lost the Senate again, he picked up 9 seats. And so my point is, if you think he's so bad, then make the argument that he should have got a bigger margin in the House, but he was the only person that did anything positive. And then you had what? You've had November, December. Was it, as I said earlier, it's like rebel without a cause. You're trying to go over the cliff and see who flinches first and jumps out of the car. And so I don't get it. And I'm getting tired of it. 48, 72 hours, fine. Let's get it. You know, Tucker had a good point. He said, you know, a little humiliation. And I said, this will be good for Kevin McCarthy to bring him down to ground zero and say, you know what? I have to be very careful what I say and do. That's always positive. But we've been there now. And every hour you are empowering those Democrats. They're not Democrats. They're hardcore leftists, socialists.
And well, so you know what I heard?
Who's happy about this, Sammy? Who's happy?
One?
Well, there are people who are very happy, and I can tell you who they are. Just everybody go to Politico, go to the Washington Post, go to the analysis on Channel 18, PBS, Channel 18 here in Fresno County, and they're happy. Or go to the Dispatch, listen to Jonah Goldberg, go look at the Bulwark and Charles Sykes, the Never Trumper. They love it. So there's a lot of people that like this. And so that's their audience that are applauding. But I think most conservatives who voted to stop the madness that the Biden revolution are not happy because they're wasting time, and they've made their point, and it was salutary and helpful, sober and judicious, whatever adjective you want. And now it's time to close ranks and bring those people and put them under oath and find out what's been happening with Twitter and the FBI and the Biden $50 million profit machine, and what whether Mark Milley really did call his Chinese counterpart and tip him off that he thought Trump was great. There's a lot of things we need to know about, and this is not the way to get it.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to, or I've been hearing that those who are against McCarthy have demanded private things for themselves. And I saw that young Colorado representative go on. I think her last name is Boebert. But
yeah, Boebert. I've spoken with her. I've been on a venue where she was speaking.
She said that what they were trying to force with McCarthy is get the budget under control and get the border under control. And that was what she said their requests were. And so I was wondering, I mean, that sounds absolutely reasonable. Like, doesn't McCarthy already want to do that? I mean, why are they even having to ask him?
So he's not Speaker of the House, right? He's never been Speaker of the House in his life. So he's been only a minority leader. And when John Boehner lost, you know, when he had some conservatives push back, he quit. And then Paul Ryan came in. And in 2018, they lost over, 42 seats? And he quit because he couldn't take the conservative base. And so this conservative base, and Kevin didn't quit, did he? He stayed in there. He's fighting. He's trying to accommodate them. And he hasn't had any power whatsoever on any budget. They rammed through this budget before the new Congress was sworn in. It was the old people, the old Congress. So, yes, if he goes in there and he does what Mitch McConnell does and makes photo op appearances with Joe Biden and greenlights this thing, this horrific omnibus bill, then he deserves to be kicked out. But he hasn't done that yet. And maybe it's good that they reminded him that he can never do that. But that only takes 48 hours. And now it's counterproductive. And I don't think that he's going to allow that to happen. But you only have one third of the government. And of that one third, you know, you're down to five votes. There was a 9-9 switch, but it's really five votes. You know, they lost five. We picked up five votes. And so you got to be very careful. If you're Nancy Pelosi and you've got sort of a commissar system where you don't allow anybody to deviate whatsoever, or Nancy calls you in and says, you're not going to be on any committee. You're not flying home in my private plane to California. That kind of stuff. Or the public plane, I should say. So the point I'm making is that Kevin hasn't done that. He hasn't been dictatorial. And you have a good point. We don't know what they want, but the rumors are coming fast and furious that they go in there and they want to leapfrog over the seniority system and cut me a deal. I want that committee. I want my friend on that committee. I want this. Well, then somebody else is going to come in and say, I voted for you. And I have 10 years more seniority than that person in the Freedom Caucus, and you just leapfrog them above me. So they've got to be a little realistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Victor, let's go ahead and take a moment for some messages, and we'll come right back to talk a little bit about the Ukrainian war. We'll be right back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe.
It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome back, Victor. So if we can turn to the Ukrainian war, I don't know if you had anything more you wanted to say about McCarthy.
I hope by Monday morning, the subpoenas start flying out.
Yeah. Okay. So on the Ukraine war, back to it, I keep hearing these reports that the Ukraine has Western weapons, has Western defenses, et cetera. And it just seems like it's getting closer and closer to, well, Russia may finally make a decision to draw the West in some way into the war. And I was wondering at this point, what are your thoughts on that or other things on the Ukrainian war?
Well, two things are, they're in a stalemate, as we know, along the border lines. But here's what's happening is that Russia is pouring 300,000 additional troops, and they're not properly trained, but they're people. So they have more troops on the ground than Ukrainians. But the Ukrainians are battle-hardened, and they have a cause they believe in, and they're fighting on their home territory, they believe. So that's of some advantage. Again, I keep saying they don't have the 1/30th the size of Russia. They have about 1/4 the population. They have 1/10 the GDP. But you start pouring in European NATO weaponry in the United States, and you get up to nearly $250 billion. And these weapons are better than Russians. Then you start to see some dramatic changes, like these HIMARS missile systems that can put a missile within a foot of something. And you get a drones and sophisticated drones. They say there's a, you know, 600,000-700,000 Russians are right next to an ammo depot. Let's blow it up. And I don't think 80 people died. I think it's more like 200 or 300. And so they're doing things like that, and they're getting very good at it. But the question is, are they getting very good at it to achieve the results that their strategic doctrine now demands? And what they've said is, it's not going to be like February 23rd, 2022. We're going back to 2014. I guess the subtext is that Obama didn't do anything for us. He just said, you know, tell Vladimir on that hot mic and soul in 2012. He said, tell Vladimir, I need some space, and I'll be flexible on missile defense. And he didn't do anything. And then Vladimir said, okay, I won't embarrass you. And you dismantle missile defense in Eastern Europe. And I won't go into Ukraine until, I don't know, 2014. And don't say a word about it. And we didn't. Nice deal. You get it. And so the point I'm making is that Russia is entrenched there. It's been there for what, seven? No. Since 2000, you can argue all the way back to 2014. So they've been there for going on 9 years. And the idea that you're going to push all of those people out with the resources that you have is going to be very difficult. And then you've got to get assurances that you've got enough artillery shells, that you've got they got a Patriot platform. You know, those are $1 billion each one. And each missile, I think, is $1 million. And they've got these sophisticated German systems that I think they fire a 30 millimeter cannon at drones and missiles that are very effective. But, you know, the artillery is made, the ammunition is made, I think, in Switzerland, and Switzerland won't let them be resupplied because they're neutral. So the point I'm making is that Ukraine's strategic objectives are not yet compatible with their diplomatic environment. They haven't said to the United States and Germany and France and NATO and the EU, we're going to need a couple of billion dollars more, a couple of hundred billion, excuse me. And to get these people out, we're going to have to do stuff. We're going to have to blow up barracks, kill a bunch of 18-year-olds. And we're going to have to sink a couple of big ships in the Black Sea fleet. And we're going to have to hit some oil depots and ammo depots inside Mother Russia, maybe even Belarus. Who knows? And what are they going to say? What are we going to say? We're going to say what? Yeah, go ahead. Here's another $100 billion. You're founding democracy in Ukraine. And I just think at some point the American people, as we sink into recession, and Zelensky has this expanded strategic vision of where he wants to be, but he doesn't have the tactical wherewithal to achieve it, that he's going to be making more and more demands on us. And at some point, somebody's going to stand up and say, the emperor doesn't have any clothes, because our strategic interests are not identical to Ukraine's. They are identical in the sense that up to a certain point, we want them to stop Putin and inflict harm on his dictatorship and promote the environment in which a democracy could emerge. But at some point, when you get to the critical red line that you are attacking Russians in Russia with American weapons, and these weapons cannot be stopped, and Putin, you know, as he sits in his cubicle, says to himself, I would have won this if it hadn't been for the United States. And our argument has been always, well, you did it to us in Afghanistan, and you did it in Iraq, and you did it in Vietnam, and we didn't go to war. He knows that. That's why he hasn't done anything yet. But I'm not sure that that's going to be, I mean, at some point he's going to get desperate. So my point is, we need to sit down with Zelensky and say, what do you want to do to start talking to Putin? You've lost probably 100,000 people. You've lost 8 million people have left your country. You probably lost $1 trillion in GDP. What do you want to do? Do you want to get every single Russian out of all the borderlands? You want to get 20% back, 30%? Tell us what you want to do. And nobody's talking like that. They think, you know, I understand that war, there's a fog of war, but at some point somebody's going to have to say, as soon as we had Pearl Harbor, Churchill and the Atlantic Charter, I mean, it was kind of naive and idealistic, but they basically have a doctrine. It's going to be Europe first. The United States is going to attack Germany, which hadn't attacked us first, and it's going to make Japan, in theory, a secondary theater that had attacked us. That was very controversial. And we're going to have an unconditional surrender, unlike World War I. And then he gave an outline of what we were going to produce. And that was pretty much almost immediate. But we haven't heard that. We haven't heard what our American goals are in Ukraine. Yeah. And somebody needs to say, you know, $300 billion, $500 billion, whatever it takes, we'll keep to the last Ukrainian, we'll give you $1 trillion. But at some point, you just can't say, oh, I'm for democracy and I'm morally superior. There's something weird about this whole thing is what I'm trying to get at. Very clumsily, I admit. But you have all these leftists who are anti-war demagogues. And these are the people who voted against, you know, the first Gulf War. These are the people who voted against the Afghanistan incursion or retaliation. These are the people who have always been against the military budget. And all of a sudden they're saying, why don't we give them 5 Patriots? Why don't we have more missiles? Come on. We've got to give them everything they want. We've got to go over there. Where's our advisors? We need advisors over there. It's the weirdest thing in the world.
And I can tell you why they're doing it. Because
okay. I have a theory, but I'd like to hear yours
too.
First.
That they have been fighting a war here in the United States against Donald Trump, where they say he sided with Putin.
Yes,
he is corrupted by Putin. And now they're fighting a war basically against Putin. I mean, obviously
And it's even sicker than that. They feel that as Wile E. Coyotes, they had Roadrunner's neck. They had their arms around his neck. And every time he went beep, beep, and he got out. And they had Putin, they feel that they had him with Russian collusion, and they had him with the Alpha Bank pings, and then they had him with the Russian disinformation and Hunter's laptop, and then they got him off Twitter. and they never could prove anything about Russian collusion, and Putin is evil. So now they've transmogrified all of that disappointment to, we're going to show everybody that we are so morally superior, even if we couldn't prove that Donald Trump was in league with this evil Putin, we're going to destroy the evil Putin. We've got Trump now with the taxes, and we've got him with Mar-a-Lago with the special prosecutor, but now we're going to go after his partner, Putin. And that's, if you took Putin out of the equation and just had, oh, I don't know, a Russian oligarch in there that invaded Ukraine, probably wouldn't be nearly as emotional to the left. They wouldn't, no. I mean, they would deplore. I mean, come on, it wasn't, was it? I don't have to speculate. So Mike McFaul was ambassador to Russia under the Obama administration. He was the architect, you know, he's very proud of that. He was the architect of reset, right? But that came right after the invasion of Georgia-Ossetia. So when he went in there, why didn't they say, he went in there, Putin did. And then when he went into Eastern Ukraine and Crimea in 2014, why didn't we send all these weapons to him, to the Ukrainian? They wouldn't even send him offensive weapons, which was so ironic about the first impeachment. They impeached Donald Trump for putting a 6 to 8 week hold on offensive weapons, which he approved, which they did not. And they got the offensive javelin weapons, which they never got under Obama. So my point is, why didn't they go after Putin in 2014 when he went in there? And the answer was, he was not tainted in their mind with Donald Trump. That's exactly right.
So one further question on this. I was reading in, speaking of Politico as a left-wing magazine, of course I read left-wing stuff so I can talk to you and see what you have to say about
the opinions. I hope that's the reason why. I hope you haven't had a conversion or something.
Gone to the dark side. No, I have not. So, but this article was arguing that that in fact, Zelensky's speech claiming that it was an investment in democracy was right, and that the Ukraine is a coming democrat, well, is a democratic state. They didn't even, and the only reason that it hadn't been such was because it was under Soviet-led corruption and kleptocracy earlier. So that basically it said that the Soviets had corrupted the Ukrainians and now they would be different.
sort of, kind of, maybe. I mean, it was 1991, right?
Yeah.
The Berlin Wall fell in 89, and this Soviet Union was broken apart completely by 1991. So they've had over 30 years. And as we learned from the first impeachment and the prior election of 2016 and Hunter's own laptop stories, they were utterly corrupt. When Joe Biden, remember all that braggadocio? I went over there and I said, look, I looked at my watch and I said, you know what? I want that guy fired. And son of a bitch, he was fired. That was just utter corruption. I mean, and that first impeachment was corruption. And their ambassador in 2016 was writing op-eds and was in cahoots with Hillary Clinton's campaign. So if they wanted to be a model democracy, they could have been like Poland, maybe. Or maybe, I don't know. Other parts of the Soviet Union that have broken away. I mean, Estonia and Lithuania and Latvia seem to be pretty transparent societies. So, I mean, I'm giving them some credit, but I mean, it's not as if they were a paragon of virtue suddenly, the Russian Federation made them undemocratic. So that's a little, I mean, I think he suspended habeas corpus, and there's no press freedom right now in Ukraine. You can't be an independent journalist and criticize, you know. It's kind of ironic because a lot of our information about the disastrous operations that the Russians are conducting, you know where that's coming from? It's from Russian bloggers. And they're free to blog. Putin hasn't put them in jail. And I think he's using them because he's using them to criticize the generals. If he criticized Putin, they'd be in trouble. But nevertheless, think you can be a Ukrainian journalist and go to the front and start writing exposés of negligence and incompetence. But it's not quite that we're on the side of quote unquote democracy. But
yeah, with
it's better than the alternative. The former Soviet Union dashed Russian Federation. But I'm just suggesting that there's been 200,000 people dead there. And it's ruined the economy of Ukraine. And we have lost a strategic triangulation vis-a-vis China. And we are pushing India and China and Iran and Turkey together and Russia in a kind of a weird alliance. We need to think about all of these things. And so I would like, you know, I like to say we're in Verdun. This is the Somme. This is the stalemate. And start negotiating. Do a Paris peace talk for a year or two and do something. But I don't think that Vladimir Putin has the technology and the morale in his armed forces to take all of that land and occupy it. I don't think the people in there want to be there anymore with the Russians. And I don't think that Ukraine, even with its generous allies, has the ability to expel every Russian out of there. And I don't know where that demarcation, 38 parallel type demilitarized zone is, whether it's 90% of the borderlands, 55% of what he took in 2014, but it's somewhere. And they need to negotiate to find where it is to stop it. And then they need guarantees. They need to tell Putin, this country is not going to be part of NATO. And that's in our interest. If this country was part of NATO right now, we'd be in a nuclear war, basically. So we don't want it in NATO. If the EU wants to incorporate, all the better. But we've got to understand that Russia is not going to allow a Russian partially or majority, minority, I don't know quite how we want to phrase it, Russian-speaking country that had been part of Tsarist Russia, Soviet Union, the Russian Federation for centuries. It's not going to let that into a anti-Russian, pro-Western, fully integrated with Europe society right on its doorstep. I just don't see that happening. Not unless there's a radical change in the Russian government. And so we need to say to Putin, this country is not going to be part of NATO, but in exchange for that, you have to respect the new boundaries and we have to give, you know, security guarantees. We'll see how that works.
Yeah, but we'll see how that works. Well, Victor, let's go ahead and take another break and come back and talk a little bit about the world economy and the role of China in that world economy. We'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back. And Victor, I know that you're writing a new book right now, and I was wondering if I could give you a little time to advertise it.
Yeah, well, I've got.
What's it about? Yeah.
I've talked about it with you once, and Sammy. It's called The End of Everything. I'm about halfway. I had that detour where I'm looking at the chapters I tried to write during the long COVID episode, and I've got to redo them because some of them are lunatic. But I have the you know, I'm trying to show that it's very rare in conflict to destroy not just the army and declare victory, but to destroy the entire civilization, language, religion, so it doesn't exist anymore. And there are a lot of studies on apocalyptic scenarios by volcanic eruptions or climate change, or just simple, you know, redrawing or redefining the map so that there is no more Yugoslavia or there's no more Prussia. But I'm talking about something different, that a war starts to escalate. You can see where I'm going vis-a-vis Ukraine. It starts to escalate, and unknowingly you get into an existential system situation where if you lose, you're going to be completely wiped out. And that's what happened to the probably the oldest and most hallowed city-state of the 1500 polis in classical Greece, Thebes, when they had no idea who Alexander the Great was. So when they rebelled and he came down there, they might have thought, well, you know, when we lose, we'll have term. No, he destroyed the entire city, and he killed thousands of them and enslaved every other person. Let the house of the poet Pindar survive, supposedly, maybe a temple or two.
Yeah, and the same
thing.
Like
so that's the first chapter, and the same thing with Carthage. I think the third time, they didn't really have a choice in some ways if they wanted to live on their feet, but they chose, I mean, to live on their knees, they didn't want to. So they chose to die on their feet, but they were completely obliterated. So you could say that there was some Punic spoken, or there was a cult of the god Baal somewhere, but not in Carthage. There were no more Carthaginians. And the same thing was true, I think, of Byzantine, Greek-speaking Orthodox culture in Asia Minor. Not that there weren't, you know, a million or two remnants of the Byzantine Empire, but on Black Tuesday, 1453, they wiped out that's what was left of that civilization. And they put minarets on Hagia Sophia, and it's a straight line to Erdogan. And then finally, I did Tenochtitlan. And I don't think that Montezuma had any idea what was in store for him when he allowed 450 conquistadors with Cortez, who was a certifiable military genius, into his city. And then at the epilogue, I'm trying to suggest that there are places in the world today where people are very vulnerable. One is Greece, 11 million people right next to Turkey, and without historical baggage. And another is Armenia. Armenia only has 3 million people, and they have been in Azerbaijan. They've been in a war with them, and that's a Turkic-speaking country. And the Kurds are, 18 million, but they're spread out, and they're completely at the mercy of four host countries. And so then we go to Ukraine. So it's not out of the ordinary to think that what happened in history can happen again with the people.
Yeah.
The elephant in the room, of course, is Israel, because we had Mr. Rafsanjani saying it was a one-bomb state 3 decades ago.
Yeah.
And you know, the Iranian theocracy's public propaganda is always, whatever it takes, we've got 120 million people. And they've probably got, I don't know, 200 nukes. So they can nuke us and nuke us and nuke us, and we'll still be here. But thank God Allah put half the Jews in the world in one place. And that's a one-bomb state. So there is it's a frightening scenario.
Yeah, remember, that's very frightening. Yep.
Yeah, it is. And if Hitler had not been stopped, or if he hadn't gone in the Soviet Union, it would be very doubtful that there would be a sizable Jewish population anywhere, except in the United States, and to a lesser extent. There wouldn't have been any Jews in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's what the book is about. And as I said, I'm going back. I had a multi-contract with Basic Book, and I did two contemporary books, The Dying Citizen, The Case for Trump, and then World War II. And this is finishing that Fort quartet. Contra.
Yeah. Do you know its publication date or about?
Yeah. Usually I always figure a year. I don't know why that is in the age of computers, but it's always a year. They have a fall and spring catalog. So I think the due date is June. And as I finish today, There's a long introduction, long epilogue, and four case studies. I've done two of the case studies and the introduction and the epilogue. I have two more to do. I think I'll make the June, unless I get
deadline. Done. Yeah.
I get the Wuhan virus again, which I had third time. So
yeah.
I'm starting to scary. Also talking about science. I'm starting to gravitate, not to conspiracy theory, but I've been reading a lot of data that is very peculiar, that more people have died from COVID who were vaccinated than not. And that's probably because older people who were, you know, vulnerable.
Get vaccinated.
And then their lifespan was closer to the end, their age was. And then there's also some data coming out that people who have never been vaccinated don't get COVID, I think, the second time as easily as people who have been vaccinated. That's more controversial. But what I'm getting at is that original thesis that was advanced by John Ioannidis, Jay Bhattacharya, and Scott Atlas, that was just denounced, Martin Kullendorf, that when you have the entire virus structure and the immune system reacts to that, it creates a different type of immunity than reacting to the spike protein alone.
Yeah.
And so, and when you flood your body with spike proteins through the messenger RNA type of vaccine, we don't quite know the effect of that. So, and I'm speaking as somebody who supported the vaccine. I was vaccinated twice, and yet I got COVID three times. So I'm prejudiced.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's turn to China. And I was looking at some discussion of China, and the assumption is that China is moving to the, to be the strong country in the world economy. And the argument was this, that the state-private partnership system is a much stronger economic model than just a complete free enterprise. And in fact, it said in this article that the view that free trade is virtue and protectionism is sin has been the bane of the U.S. policy and diplomacy in world diplomacy. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on this idea that China is the dominant state and that the dominant economic model, and the idea of a state-private system is the better system, better, or it's going to lead to a stronger state in the long run.
Yeah, I think you're referring to that tablet article by Michael Lin.
Yeah,
that just came out, and it's not quite a resurrection of Robert Reich, the Clintonian leftist who said, you know, a managed economy with a partnership, kind of like Japan Inc. And so that was the big mantra in the 90s, that, you know, GM, look at GM and those gas guzzlers, and look at the Toyos and Hondas. But we found out what happened to Japan Inc. And then we were told that the EU was the model. The euro got up to what, $1.55, and right during the Iraq War, when we were in trouble in 2008, Europe, the euro, they managed the government gets in and they get all of their captains of industries and they say, we'll give you concession here and here and here, and here's our state policy, and da 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 da, and we got to protect this group and that group. So that was the fault. But it's not new. They said that during the Soviet Union in their 5-year plans. They said, wow, I should backtrack a little, but they said it during Mussolini, during the Depression. They said, man, look at the autobahns in Germany, and look at Mussolini's done with modern architecture and highways and the trains running. It's managed capitalism. The same thing is true of the Soviet Union. Look at what they did with wheat production. And then it was, wow, look at Japan Inc. And then it was, wow, look at the European. So you got to keep it in context. Now it's China. They don't make these stupid mistakes because the government and business are the same. He's not quite making that argument as I understand him. He's trying to make the argument that free market, unfettered, laissez-faire capitalism incurs a lot of cost if everybody's not doing it. In other words, yes, if everybody's in the arena and they've all got a shield and a sword, let them go to it and you'll get the best warrior. But if some people are unarmed, they're going to get killed. And what he's saying is that we advance free market capitalism and these other countries take it seriously. And they have a nationalist capitalism and they're killing us because we take the hit. And it's time for us to do to them what they do to us, sort of. And I think that's the argument. And the problem I have with it, though, is you can separate the industrial sector and the private enterprise sector from the government and still have wise economic policy. And by that, I mean, I think Trump showed you that he wasn't creating state industries, but he tried to shock us and say, we're going to have to clamp down on China. But if you start picking winners and losers and you stifle entrepreneurialism, or you have a commissar system like we do now. And I mean that. Think of Stanford University when we have these brilliant people there and they are investigating everything from brain tumors to alternate fusion energy. But you've got 15,000 administrators to 16,000 students. And all of these diversity and equity and inclusion, they're like Soviet commissars. So they're intrusive and they are warping the market of ideas. So you don't want that. You don't want that at all. You don't want the 1937 Raisin Administrative Committee Act, where the Roosevelt, it's still in effect. The Roosevelt administration says, well, you know, there's 5 or 10,000 raisin growers and they don't know what they're doing. And the price of raisins is $30 a ton. So we're going to tell you how many raisins that you can sell in the United States. And we're going to call it the reserve and free tonnages. Free tonnage? Oh, we'll say 50%. So you're Mr. Davis and you have 100 tons. The government says 50 of those are ours. The other 50, Sun Maple sell and you'll be paid. But you're not going to get any for the other 50. We're going to send it overseas. We're going to feed soldiers with it. We're going to give it to foreign aid. And if that's still not enough to get rid of it, then we're going to, dip it in brandy and give it to cows. And they did. And when I was farming full time, there was always a reserve tonnage. And they own it. The government owns it. They come into your place and say, you know what, Mr. Hansen, you have 200 tons of raisins. And you've got to take them all into your packer, but you don't own them. And if you say, you know what, I'm just going to take half on the free tonnage and I'll just keep the other half here. No, you don't own those raisins. From the moment you had a bloom on that grapevine in late March, you didn't know it, but those were our grapes. We owned them. Maybe your property, maybe your vines, maybe your farming, maybe your risk, but we own them. You do not own them. Ultimately, we own those raisins. And we're going to take half of whatever this committee decides. We're going to take that percentage from you and we're going to dump it overseas so that the domestic market price stays high. And that's what they do. And that's managed capitalism. Everybody see that? It's managed capitalism. And it doesn't work. They tried it with oranges. It doesn't work. They've tried it. Every other commodity, cotton, when I was a small boy, my dad farmed cotton. And there was a cotton allotment. And we were so lucky to get a 17-acre cotton allotment. That allowed, the government said to you, we're going to let you plant cotton. And then artificially reduce the acreage to keep the price up. So everybody went out and planted almonds, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Okay. And okay, that's free market. So
that's free market.
And
the market, yes, they did. And the market says, you know what? If you've got almonds and they're over 25 years old and you're not producing 3,000 pounds an acre, you're not going to make it at $1.53 for almonds. And if you're out on the west side and you're paying $3,000 an acre and what per acre foot, you're not going to make it. And they're coming out and the market is adjusting. And it'll be much more effective than a bureaucratic, you know, Soviet style that said, well, we're going to let you plant 50,000 acres. This, we're going to forecast that. That's, I mean, neither system is perfect, but the private sector is more effective. But what Linda's trying to say is, okay, but you have to have a government that has the interest of the majority of Americans first, not just the capitalist entrepreneurial class. So that means, what would that mean? It means if they steal stuff, and they do, then you reciprocate. If they take your copyrights or your patents, or they dump materials on the market below the cost of production, you cite them. You know, if they manipulate the currency exchange so that they can favor greater exports, you react in the interest of your own people. And I get that. That's absolutely true. Or if you want to attract capital and industry from Europe and they're paying 50 cents a kilowatt hour, the equivalent in euros, then maybe you can try to have more federal leases. We're not doing it, but it would be wise. Trump did it to lower the price of natural gas so you could generate electricity at a cheaper cost. And then maybe an aluminum smelter or calcium nitrate or ammonium nitrate plant would relocate here. And that's government helping the industry, but not controlling it and not interfering with it. It's trying to help America.
Yeah, definitely. The free market system has its advantages in some ways.
Yeah. So that's what I think he's arguing. But people should also read David Goldman. I mean, he's a brilliant guy, and he writes from the financial side on China, and especially percentages of the budget in R&D, research and development. And his argument is that we get really angry at all these things that the Chinese are doing. They're dumping, they're manipulating the currency, they're stealing our patents, they're stealing our copyrights, they're stealing our research and development that they don't have to do. But people have done that to us all the time. And the real problem that we have is us. The problem, my dear Caesar, is not in the stars, it's in us. and what he means is we are spending a historic low of our GDP on research and development. You look at these great universities, Harvard, Michigan, University of Texas, UCLA, they're not spending, the government's not encouraging, and they're not researching to the extent that they have in the past. Part of it is we're a therapeutic culture, but we're really going to have to step up. And he's saying that. And when you try to subsidize or mask that failure, then you contribute to it. So what I think the series of essays he's been writing the last 2 years is something like, don't just put tariffs on Japanese computers or, you know, chips or something. Make better chips, make better computers, and then drive them out of business with a better product. Because even though they have these advantages in cheaper labor costs, we can automate. We have artificial intelligence. If our universities are so much better, you know what I mean? So that's what he's saying. And I think he's right about that. That we've got too many psych majors, too many sociology majors, too many environmental studies majors, too many gender studies, too many Black studies, Asian studies, you name it, studies, leisure studies, rec studies, and not enough STEM stuff.
They all became woke, and it's kind of like a zombie thing. It's not like a...
It's a drag on the economy, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that too.
Every time I'm trying to look at a classical secondary work, when I look at a German, you know, a history of Rome or an article on classical military, and I see Germany, from the late 20s, but especially after 33, all the way to 45, it's worthless. It's just completely worthless because it's going to be contaminated by the Nazi government. And it's usually going to be on racial categories or whether this particular Greek city state was of this particular race or the Helots and all. Well, what was the racial pedigree of the Helots? It's just worthless. So you've got to be understanding what woke does. Yeah, what woke does. It's taken a, it's like a vacuum cleaner that vacuumed the minds of an entire generation and blew their brains out. But I'm talking across the board. So if you're in English or you're in French history or you're in medieval studies, and you look at these journals and what they're publishing, and it's transgenderism in 1250, you know, was Charles Martel gay, Richard the Lionhearted had a boy, this kind of stuff. And it's not, it's just worthless. And that's,
it's worthless. And they write about it as though it's all completely new, as though nobody else has ever written about it.
It's just it's just a bastard extension of, you know, Michel Foucault and Derrida and Lacan and the phallocentric power machinations of who constructed the reality, all that crap.
Yeah,
and,
sure,
and it's just a waste of investment. And it's really sad, because had we not been doing all this stuff, and if we'd quit it right now, I mean, do we really need thousands of diversity czars? What are they doing? It's not that they're neutral. I wouldn't mind if we just paid a guy to be a diversity, equity, inclusion, gave him $150,000, $200,000, and just say, go over there on campus and read a book and don't bother anybody. But they're negative impacts. They go in and they disrupt research and teaching and instruction. And they make all these psychodomes. And they're everywhere. They're in corporate America. They're in the government. They're in the university. They're in K-12. So it's a commissar. We don't have the guts to admit it, that we did this to ourselves. But it's very similar to the Russian commissar system.
Well, Victor, we're coming to the end of the time, but I did want to ask you about Pope Benedict the 16th. And he recently passed away. And what I was reading on it was Pope Francis gave a homily to him and hardly even mentioned Benedict himself in the homily. So it was kind of weird, but we're sad that he has passed away. Did you have anything in the last couple of minutes to say?
Well, you know, Pope Benedict the 16th was a scholar, and he was a polyglot. And he wrote very sophisticated exegesis on not just on church doctrine, but he went, you know, he went back through the history of the church. He was, gosh, he was an expert on Saint Peter and how did, you know, how did the Pope's office, and he talked about even the dress and the customs of the liturgies and the bishops and the cardinals, and how this grew out of the late Roman Empire, the political, the basilica. So he was a student of the early church, is what I'm trying to say, both the material church and the philosophical underpinnings, and how that classical tradition, that pagan tradition, through people like Jerome, but especially Augustine, how that was transmogrified in the church. He was brilliant, but he was kind of a scholar. He wasn't a guy who was, you know, like Pope John II, you know, the Polish Pope, that was a man of the people, vigorous skier and all that. You know, he was 95 when he died. But when you say, and I wasn't aware quite, you know, I had heard that, but I wasn't quite sure about Pope Francis, if that was a snub. But remember, just take one topic, how much the church has changed. So Pope Benedict, if you got, say you're dealing with, I don't know, at that time it was AIDS. He was trying to say that if you're married and you're faithful to your marriage vows and you follow chastity, then you're not going to get AIDS. Whereas Francis would say, who are you to judge? And we're causing all kinds of stress on the gay community by suggesting that. Who are we to say that their type, that community or that constituency's sex is any more likely? That's what I'm trying to say. And he's a intellectual lightweight compared to Benedict. And he's a socialist. He comes out of the Argentine leftist movement. And so he's not faithful to church doctrine, is what I'm trying to say. He's not a scholar. And he's a political activist. And I don't know what to say, but he said things. Benedict had to leave because he was getting into topics that you don't really want to get into in the modern world, like, you know, gay marriage and homosexual lifestyles and technology and all of that. He was starting to abortion and everything. The Catholic Church under Francis is sort of indistinguishable between HHS and the NIH and the WHO and the campus provost. That's kind of what the Catholic Church's hierarchy is right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, Victor, thank you so much for all your insights into current world events and problems. We're very appreciative of that.
Thank you for hosting, and thank everybody for listening tonight. I've had a sinus infection, so I've got a lisp tonight. My face, so I sound funny. At least I do in my headphones, but it's because I've kind of stuffed up.
You don't sound funny at all.
Oh, good.
You're just fine, Victor.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks, everybody. This is Victor Davis Hanson and Sammy Wink, and we're signing off.
Thank you, everybody.